Welcome. Always glad to have you here on Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Coming up, let the games begin. Board games, that is. Platypus Con is back again. How there are more than 1,000 games to try out. After more than 2 years in the pandemic mode, the Learning Connection is ready to connect with in-person classes. How climate change has upended all the rules for gardening in Southeast Alaska. We'll take a look at what's happening at the Jensen Olsen Arboretum. Some of the conversations you can look forward to on this Tuesday's Juno Afternoon. In the Juno forecast for tonight and tomorrow morning, mostly cloudy, but drivers be sure and watch out for areas of fog and freezing fog later on tonight, with visibility 1/4 of a mile or less at times. Also tonight and tomorrow, a chance of rain and snow showers, lows in the lower 30s with light winds. As the day progresses tomorrow, mostly cloudy skies, highs in the upper 30s. Now for tomorrow night, cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow, lows in the lower 30s with east winds around 10 miles per hour. Through Thursday and Thursday night, a chance of rain and snow with the snow level at 1,500 feet. Otherwise, look for mostly cloudy skies, highs in the upper 30s with lows in the mid 30s. By Friday, snow mixed with rain is likely a pattern we'll see continue through Sunday, when it is finally expected to get colder, and by Monday we should see lows in the lower 20s, highs in the mid-20s, a significant drop in temperatures with more snow possible. Sun rises at 8:11 tomorrow morning, sets at 4:09 in the afternoon, and that gives us about 7 hours and 53 minutes of daylight.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
KTOO would like to take a moment to acknowledge that we are on the homelands of the Thlinkit. In the borough of Juno, we have the two Kwans, the Akwan and the Takukwan. KTOO studios sit on the ancestral home of the Hlinedi, or dog salmon people of the Akwan. We acknowledge those families of the Hlinedi who made use of these lands and waterways for thousands of years and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
Hanson Gress. Ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khanakaya ha ani kak gunish cheese.
Gunish cheese for being here with us today. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. So I want you to think for a minute. What was your favorite board game growing up? Well, mine was Monopoly, and my friends and I also loved the game Clue. We could play that for hours, so I am probably dating myself with my answers because today's board games have names like Transforming Mars, Bastion, Furnace, Wild Space, but as Shakespeare said, what's in a name? Well, our guest today has proven again and again that the love of board games is a timeless thing. And joining me now is Joshua Warren. He's president of Platypus Gaming, the company that organizes Platypus Con, an annual convention in Juneau, which gets underway this coming weekend. So welcome, Joshua. And maybe we should start off by talking about why you started this convention.
Hi, thanks for having me. the reason we started the convention, I'd gone to some large conventions down south, and I know it can be cost prohibitive and also a little bit too large for those conventions. So we wanted to create sort of a local experience that people could do, especially in the winter when sometimes there's not a lot to do.
So you were on hiatus for 1 year because of COVID. And so I imagine that you've probably had a lot of people asking you, when are you coming back? And I guess this is going to be in person, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, we had a lot of people pretty sad that we had to cancel last year, but it was pretty inevitable. There wasn't a vaccine yet at that point. And the reason that we're able to do it this year is we're following the CBJ guidelines. So everyone is going to have to bring proof of vaccination. And we're also going to have to wear masks in the convention. But we're trying really hard to make it a safe event for everyone. Some of the tables that generally have strangers have to be widened up so you can sit a little bit further apart but still play a game. So we're trying to make it so it's a fun, safe experience.
Boy, that would be kind of hard to move online board games, even though I guess people play digital games online all the time. But that would just kind of spoil the fun out of it, don't you think, if this somehow had to be moved online?
It definitely would take quite a bit of the joy out of it. There are some good platforms that we did advertise during the pandemic as a slight alternative, but it's going to be really great to play with people again and see them again.
Do you think people are hungry for that aspect of it? Even though we have to have masks and some distancing, there's still that in-person quality to things.
Definitely. That's part of the reason both the creation plan was actually going back to that and why I like board games is it is an inherently social experience. I'm not great at being social, but if I have a game to talk about while being social, I'm infinitely better at it.
Well, I guess that's the beauty of board games is you can be social across different generations with people you have nothing apparently in common with. But you do have the board game in common. I'm curious, so what was your favorite board game?
I will say, as a kid, I also liked Monopoly and Clue. But in that same generation of games, there was Acquire, which is really great. It's an older game, I think, from the 70s. But I've moved on from most of those games, but I won't chagrin people from playing them.
I liked Monopoly because it could go on and on and on, and you could be down and out. And if you just hung in there, you might, you know, pass go enough times, collect a couple $100 and be back in. I always liked that there was always a chance to succeed at Monopoly, but board games are so different today. I mean, some of the names, you know, I mentioned earlier, Bastion, Furnace, and of course everybody has heard about Dungeons and Dragons. Tell us about kind of the thinking behind modern games as opposed to some of the older ones that we used to play.
I think a lot of modern board games are really just taking, I'm always surprised that they're able to do new things with the same components. We probably have hundreds of card games, and you wouldn't think there could be hundreds of thousands of different interesting card games, but I think each one is unique in its own way and brings a lot of fun. So I don't like, there are quite a few games nowadays that require an app, which is definitely a modern thing. But I think a lot of the games today could have existed when I was younger. They just didn't happen yet. So I think it's really great to see lots of new designers come out and just twist things a little bit to make new games.
Well, I have had friends play Scrabble and cheat by going online to look for words. So I wonder if there's a lot of hybrid game playing going on today. But how many games do you personally have?
The library for PlatypusCon is probably 95% mine, and we have around 2,000 games.
My goodness. So because you collect so many games, I'm presuming that you've tested them all?
That would be a false presumption. I'm going to try to do better in the future. I'm trying to scale back a little bit. I would say there's probably 300 to 400 of those that I haven't played. But almost all of them I've read the rule book. So I bet almost all of them could get going pretty quickly. But I have not yet played them all.
1,600 games, though, that you've tried at least. So what, in your mind, makes a good game?
Sort of actually calling back to what you said, I think a good game is one where you don't know who's going to win until near the end. Because it's never a ton of fun to be in like an hour-long game and 15 minutes in, you know you're not going to win. And also just what makes a good game is a game that you love. So one of the first questions we ask when people come and don't know what game to play it's what games have you played and enjoyed. For those Scrabble people, there's a ton of new word games that they might really enjoy if they enjoy Scrabble.
So explain to me, and for those who are uninitiated, how Platypus Con works. I mean, you pay a fee to get in. How do you handle all of that?
So when you show up, or you can order them online still, a weekend badge for an adult is $35, and there are single days, which are cheaper. But essentially, once you show up, you're given a badge. You're given a commemorative die, which you've had every year. But with that badge, you can just walk into the library. They'll scan the barcode on your badge and scan the barcode of the game, and you just take it into the large ballrooms and play a game. We also have people teaching some games, so if you don't want to try to learn one yourself, we're happy to teach you.
So,
but we try to keep everything free inside.
So this has been advertised as a family event as well, or that it can be family friendly. How does that work, and what age range are you thinking about with kids?
We've had very young kids almost every year. Again, we do require vaccination, so the very bottom cusp we're probably not going to be able to see this year. But we've seen people well into their retirement, and we've also seen whole families playing together. There are tons of new games that are definitely designed for single-digit kids. So
how does that work? Does the family, do the parents have to supervise the kids, or do you find that the chaos is kind of naturally orderly when it comes to game playing?
We do ask that if they're under 12, they have someone to make sure they behave. But if they're behaving and the parents want to go home, sometimes we'll make some small exceptions. But in general, once kids are playing in a game, they're not going to be too wily. Sometimes we need to tell them to run a little bit less. But we haven't had too many behavioral problems.
Well, kids have so much available to them that we didn't have, because many of them, you know, have played games on their parents' iPhones while they're waiting. You know, if their dad has a Peloton and he's having a virtual jogging experience or whatever. I mean, kids live in this realm. So I have to wonder, do board games still have that kind of attraction for this generation? And if they do, what is it?
I think a lot of the games I've seen kids playing are the games that you get to lie to each other for the sake of the game, to be deceptive and stuff like that. They enjoy the aha moment of figuring out who did something or who was the bad guy. But I still think that I think they also enjoy the social aspect that a video game on an iPad can provide them.
So I guess they get to sample the best of both worlds, but what do you think they get out of board games that maybe they can't get out of a digital connection?
That's a tough one. I played video games as a kid and board games as a kid, and I just think they're two different spheres. And the things you get from them are, I think it also keeps your brain a little bit more active than a video game, although video games can be pretty complicated too nowadays. But I think maybe, I like math, and I'm wondering if some of my math comes from enjoying things like Monopoly when I was a kid. So,
well, Monopoly had no effect on my math skills, but...
But maybe it doesn't work for everyone.
But, you know, you do have to add. You know, you have to keep track of the score, count the money. I think because of Monopoly, I was good at counting change, things like that. So there are these skills. So in some of today's games, what kind of skills do you see kids building for today's world?
If there's a theme, there's probably a game for it. So if you want to learn, there's actually a game company that entirely focuses all of their game designs on education. They just came out with a game called Genotype, which will be a play-to-win game and also a demo game at Platypus this year. And it's entirely based, the game is entirely based around Mendelbrot genetics. And that company also has, not only do they have a rule book, but they have a book about the science that the game is from in each of their games. I think that's really interesting.
So there are many platforms that games reach out to kids with. So in other words, like if you had a passion for microbiology or if you had a passion for geology, there might be a game about crystals or favorite historical events, things like that?
I think you'd be hard-pressed to not to find no game for something you're interested in. And if you can actually find it, maybe you should tell a game design company and they'll be like, finally, something new. So, because we have a lot of dinosaur games and a lot of Viking games. So I think they're trying to find new things. Like Mars has been a new thing for a while, as you mentioned, with terraforming Mars. So
what's that game like? How do you play that?
That game is, it's one of our heavier games, but essentially you're working using cards and actions to bring life to Mars through forests and water and cities. It can be a little take that, but it's still a lot of fun.
You know, I suppose you could learn some things about Mars if you were a kid playing that game, just because you'd pick up some statistics and just general scientific information as part of that game.
Definitely. A lot of the cards have what's called flavor text, where they talk about what things are. Like there are some cards that are for Phobos and Deimos, the moons of Mars, and other like talking about what kind of biology can live in colder temperatures and less oxygen temperatures. I think there's lots of room for education games.
So I picture these 2,000 games stacked up, and I'm wondering, though, will there be some that will just be the big favorites at this gathering? And what do you predict those will be?
When Terraforming Mars just came out, like it was a really hot game for a good long time, so that wouldn't be easy to predict. But I honestly don't know if there's been anything that was such a flash in the pan this year. I know Evolution is always really popular. And some of the ones, there's a lot of games coming out for Dune in the Dune universe. We probably have like 5 new games all based off that movie. One of them will be showing off and teaching you how to play. So maybe that won't be the hot one. Normally the hot ones, we try to make sure we have a demo table available for so people don't have to get flustered in the rule books.
So what about the older generation? Are they gravitating to any of these new games in particular?
I find the few people who are older, honestly, like enjoy the very similar games. They'll probably know of some old ones. Like there's some old games in our collection. Like we have Twixt and we have Acquire, as I mentioned, that we might only have because the older generation recommended them to us. If people like want a game to be in our library and request it, I will generally get it for our library just so people can show their favorite friends. But I think board games, one of the other things it gives is it is pretty big uniter. I don't think there's any games that are only for certain age groups.
Well, we have kind of been locked away for part of COVID. A lot of people had to self-isolate. So people spent a lot more time at home than they normally would, watching movies, playing games. So how did that affect game playing? Do you think that some of the old Scrabble games came out and card games during these COVID isolation periods?
I would hope so. I know that since I couldn't go out and play games with some of my other friends, that we played more games with just me and my wife than we probably would normally. And I do think it would have been if you had a family of 3 or 4, it would be a great activity that you could do while still keeping a bubble tight. So I do think that they probably came out quite a bit.
So what about post-COVID? Do you think that because games are essentially social in a lot of ways that we might see a renewed interest in game playing with board games?
I think when we actually get to post-COVID, I think there are going to be more people into board games than we had going into COVID. Simply for that reason of people trying to find things to do while they're safe at home. Like I'm sure there's a lot more bakers after COVID than there were before COVID. I think there's probably more board gamers now. And we look forward to seeing them if they want to join us.
So you've got volunteers involved in this, people that help out, take tickets, do things like that. Are you still looking for volunteers?
We will always take more volunteers. On our Facebook page, there is a link to a form you can fill out to be a volunteer. And I really appreciate all the volunteers we have and had. There's definitely no way I could do it without them helping us. So, but if you do volunteer, I think we say 8 hours during the event, we can even give you a free badge if that's something that, if the price of the badge winds up being a concern for you. You can volunteer with us and come for free.
So you can purchase a ticket in advance by going to your website. And from what I understand, this thing, Friday and Saturday, goes until like 2 in the morning at Centennial Hall.
We do. We start at 6 p.m., go to 2 a.m. The next day it's 10 a.m. to 2 a.m. The next day we definitely have a reprieve. We only go from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Sunday. But it is, we try to stay open as much as we can. We're not quite 24-hour gaming. I need to get sleep sometime.
But do the kids enjoy that, being able to stay up late? At least you know where they are if they're out and about.
Yeah. We don't have too many people at 1 in the morning, but I think they appreciate being able to play till 1 in the morning. Some of them will be playing a board game that takes 4 hours, so if they started at 10, they need the time.
So what about snacks? I mean, you can't play a game without some popcorn or, you know, some sodas. Can you buy them there, or should you bring refreshments with you?
We definitely have refreshments you can buy. We have energy drinks if you're some of our 2 a.m. people who need a little pick-me-up. But outside of, like, we try to have some healthy snacks available, but people are free to bring in dinner if they want. I don't expect people to only buy our snack food for, they're going to stay 10 a.m. through 2 a.m. on Saturday.
And so you can come and go once you have the pass. So you could go out and get a dinner break or whatever.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to have a way to indicate that you have been checked to make sure you were vaccinated before the event so that you'll have that as well. So once you have the badge and that wristband, you can freely come and go during our hours.
So one last question for you is, where did you get the name for your business, Platypus? Why that?
It just happened to be my favorite animal, and we wanted something unique. We didn't want to be called like Juno Board Game Con. That just seemed a little too normal, and I'm not really one for normal since I love platypuses. So.
Well, for a small community like Juno, and it's relatively small, although one of the larger communities in Alaska, it's pretty amazing that you have something like this available. I mean, how unusual is it for a small community to have a conference like this?
I think it's pretty rare because down south in Lower 48, there are regional conventions that are still, even the smaller ones are bigger than us, and it's because people can just drive to another hub and go to one. But I think we're fairly unique in that we just don't have an easy way to go to all those other cons. So that's why we did this one, is to try to provide a similar experience locally.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us, to tell us about this year's Platypus Con, and that it happens to be your favorite animal. Now we know why it's called that. Thanks so much, Joshua Warren, president of Platypus Con.
Look forward to playing with everyone.
All right.
This is Steve Kostas with the Breach Egg Planetarium, and I'm going to talk about darkness here in Juneau. So in late January, sunset is around 3:50 p.m., and 50 minutes after sunset, when the sun is 6 degrees below the horizon, which is about a fist at arm's length, we have what's called civil twilight. If you wait another 50 minutes, when the sun is 12 degrees below the horizon, we have what's called nautical twilight. And another 50 minutes after that, we have the end of what's called astronomical twilight and the beginning of astronomical darkness. So what astronomical darkness means is that the sun is more than 18 degrees below the horizon, and that's the best time to see faint objects in the sky, such as the northern lights. So at our latitude, from late August to late April, we have astronomical darkness. And it turns out that that's the best time to see the northern lights. But for various reasons, the northern lights are more frequent during the March equinox, which is around March 20th. So as we approach late April into late August, that's when the sun is not more than 18 degrees below the horizon, And so that's the period of time in our latitude when we have midnight twilight. Now, what's interesting is if you head further south towards the equator of our planet, twilight is much shorter. In fact, close to the equator, right after sunset, it seems to get dark very, very, very soon after twilight because the sun is setting at a more oblique angle. So the Marie Drake Planetarium, we're starting to do public shows again, and they'll be announced on our website at mariedrakeplanetarium.org. Thank you.
Next, CERC is bringing back in-person classes for adult education. Thank you for joining us for Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Southeast Regional Resource Center is probably best known for Learning Connection, an adult education program that helps people get their GEDs, prepare for college, learn English, acquire new computer skills, and the services are the best price of all, absolutely free if you sign up and go through the registration process. And joining us to talk about the Learning Connection, Genevieve Schmidt. She is the Adult Education Coordinator for CERC. Welcome, Genevieve. It's good to have you here with us to tell us about how CERC is planning to phase in in-person classes, because I can imagine that that is really welcome news.
Yes, thank you, Rhonda.
So I imagine that that was quite a bit of work to go remotely during, what, the last couple of years?
Yes, yeah, we will be having in-person classes for the first time in 23 months. So big deal.
Yes, and I would imagine that for the population, the type of people that you're serving, that going online could be challenging from an income standpoint, having expendable income to have the computers, to be able to have internet access. I mean, how did you make that work?
So we actually Zoomed with a lot of people using their iPhones or using FaceTime. And so people were able to connect with us virtually that way. We also have an online learning platform where people can use it to study at their own pace. So if they need support, we can offer it via tutors. But having that online support and the ability to use physical materials, like coming in and picking up books and things like that, that was another way that people could still work on their skills.
Mm-hmm. So were there any subsidies to help people with internet access?
Yeah, there were some federal broadband assistance, and that's still going on. I know that Tlingit and Haida also had some financial assistance for internet, along with those who had children in the local school district. They were given access to technology, and so people were using those little helpers to be able to connect with us as well.
So did you find participation dropped during those 23 months?
It did somewhat, but our retention rate actually improved. So while we did have a small decrease in the amount of students that we were working with, the amount of people who were able to keep on after a certain amount of time actually went up. So because people had to put in more effort into learning a little bit. So it worked out well in some cases, and in others, unfortunately, it didn't.
We have so many lessons that we are learning from the trade-offs of in-person versus virtual. And I imagine, too, mm-hmm. that it's easier to attend maybe if you're doing it from your home.
Yes. Childcare and transportation are large barriers for a lot of the people that we work with. So not having to worry about those really made it more possible for people who had children who were being homeschooled or, you know, were working from home during the pandemic.
So let's talk a little bit about the local economy, because we've heard that some businesses have had worker shortages, that a lot of people left after COVID and they either found something else or just didn't want to come back. So do you feel like what you're doing, the training you're providing for people, do you think that's going to help with that?
I do, especially because the need, the trainings that we're providing are needed here locally. So specifically paraeducators, which are also known as classroom aides or teacher's assistants. They go by many different names. But having that need here in Juneau, we decided to, as an educational agency, we have a lot of background in training teacher's assistants and classroom aides, et cetera. And so we have a paraeducator training coming up. And we also have a direct service provider training, both of which are definitely needed here in Juneau. And all over Southeast, really.
So your paraeducator training, do you think that it could be, first of all, it probably helps if you have children because you're kind of already in the schools. But do you think it could be sort of a stepping stone to a better career down the road?
Definitely, yeah. We specifically chose paraeducators because since it's in the school system, it is a potential career option with benefits, and it runs on the same schedule as a child's school does. So it's really a good option for those parents who already have children in the schools. And yeah, it's definitely a stepping stone to having that experience to becoming a teacher yourself or working in administration. It's definitely a stepping stone.
So tell us a little bit, if you're interested in this online paraeducator training program, as well as the in-person direct service provider trainings. How do you access that? How do you find out more?
So you can email us at at serrccirc.org, or you can go to our Facebook or Instagram, serrc.tlc or TLC Juno, and you can DM us and we'll walk you through the registration process.
Now, you've also got computer assistants available. And are you going to teach those in person as well?
Yes, our computer assistance classes will be in person starting Thursday, February 17th from 9:30 to 11 a.m. And then after that, they'll be every Tuesday and Thursday through May.
So what kind of a person should come to this program? I mean, where should they be? What skill level should they have?
Absolutely any skill level. If you don't have an email, we can help you get that set up. If you're not familiar with using Alaska Jobs, the new job search engine, we can help walk you through that as well. There is no computer skill too small for us to walk you through. Even if it's creating your resume or opening and saving things in the Google Suite, we can help you with that.
Well, I could use some help with this Google Doc thing. That one boggles my mind, especially where you open it up and you make edits. And other reporters tell me, just use Google Doc, will you? And I come from the school of scratch it out in red ink and make your notes. But so you could learn all the different Google programs through this.
Yes.
Wow. So people are going to be able to use those skills directly on the job. What kind of experience do you have tracking people and knowing whether or not these trainings are a pathway to real jobs and better opportunities?
So there's a couple different ways. So some people we're able to keep in touch with years after the fact. Others don't keep the same phone number and email address. So we do have to rely on the state's data. When someone registers with us, we do have to pass their information onto the state because that's how we're funded. But they're able to track people's income up to a year after they leave our services. So we can track, or they can track, not I, but they can see how much people are, how much their income is improving after they exit.
What do you know sort of just from being with the program? What are you hearing from people about how CERC is able to plug them into new opportunities?
It's pretty positive. People really like that since we're small and we're local, we really understand what's going on locally, and we have strong community connections with other social service agencies. And so there is a strong referral system. So that way, and our strong supports to be able to assist people getting into those other social supports and agencies as well.
So what about English as a second language? That's another really important service that you offer. So that's mm-hmm. going back to in-person as well, I understand.
Yes.
So will it be done differently because of COVID?
So we are having everybody 6 feet apart, CVJ standards, and we are staff instructors will be wearing the face shields and have extra distance or materials to separate them, because so much of ESL is seeing how the mouth is moving and making specific mouth movements. So for the ESL classes, we will be having face shields, so that way students can see the mouth movements.
Yeah, I guess that's true, is that you've got to be able to see the lips move to be able to duplicate sounds. Plus, you know, you're respirating a lot, breathing in and out to make yeah. these sounds. But this is really good news. I imagine that that would be a hard subject to teach online.
In some ways, it was nice because I could share my screen and use Google Translate. It's easier than writing on a board to just type it into my laptop and be able to share a Google Doc and have the students be able to read it, and we can create sentences in real time together without having to try to read someone's handwriting. It makes it a little bit easier that way.
Well, just before we go, one thing I did want to ask you about is your background, because from what I understand, you were an AmeriCorps volunteer. That's how you came to Juno. And so now you are working in CERC's program and helping people with their adult education, get things that will lead them to better opportunities, we hope. How do you like this job?
I like it a lot. It's really special to be able to work with people who have not had the best educational experiences or just need a little bit of help getting their skills up to where they want them to be more employable and self-sufficient.
Well, I guess that is very rewarding to know that what you're doing mm-hmm. makes a difference. So I want to thank mm-hmm. you so much for being here with us. Genevieve Schmidt, she is the Adult Education Coordinator for Southeast Alaska Regional Resource Center. You can go to CERC's website to get more information and Facebook page. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rhonda.
Thank you.
Sounds wild.
Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
On a foggy June day in the Aleutian Islands, a biologist on Howadax Island documents the call of the song sparrow. Song sparrows were absent here prior to 2008, as were many other songbirds and seabirds. Birds like these nested on the island for millennia before disappearing, and biologists are documenting their return. What happened? In 1780, a Japanese sailing ship went aground on Howadax Island, introducing invasive rats. Those rats bred and overran the island, devastating populations of native birds. Rats devour eggs, and they kill and eat mother birds as they tend their nests. Puffins and storm petrels were wiped out, and other birds were severely impacted. So profound was the invasion that the island was renamed Rat Island. Jump to the 21st century. After years of planning by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Nature Conservancy, and Island Conservation, rats were eradicated from Rat Island in 2008. The recovery of native birds and plants has been remarkable, particularly for gray-crowned rosy finches, Lapland longspurs, and snow buntings, and shorebirds like black oyster catchers and rock sandpipers. In 2012, the name of the island was officially changed back to Howadax Island, the original Aleut name meaning entry and welcome. For Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford.
Support is provided by Platypus Gaming, presenting over 2,000 games to try, play, and enjoy at Centennial Hall for their 7th annual Platypus Gaming Convention from Friday, January 28th to Sunday, January 30th. Not only will there be sessions training groups to play games such as Dune Imperium, Marvel United, and Canvas, but you can even win games simply by trying them. For more information or to buy tickets, visit platypusgaming.org. CBJ mandates require all attendees to be vaccinated against COVID-19.
Bring me a rose in the winter time, when it's hard to find. Bring me a rose in the winter time. I got roses on my mind.
Up next, the Jensen Olsen Arboretum. Why it's now become a laboratory for coping with climate change. We'll have that when we come back.
Bring me a rose in the winter time. How easy we forget. Bring me a smile when I'm far from home, when it's hard to find. Bring me a smile when I'm far from home. I got smiling on my mind. Well, a smile is sweet most any time, and yet bring me a smile when I'm far from home. How easy we forget. Bring me a kiss when my baby's grown, when it's hard to find. Bring me a kiss when my baby's grown. I got kissing on my mind. Well, a kiss is sweet most any time, and yet...
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. The Jensen Olsen Arboretum is a gardening oasis on the edge of town, a uniquely Juneau park where you will find rare primroses in the summer and all kinds of other beautiful flowers. And even though spring is still a ways out, Ginger Hudson is always busy getting ready, always getting ready. That's the nature of the job, getting ready for the next season. She's the Arboretum manager. And Ginger, I'm just curious, if you looked outside your window out at the Arboretum, what do you see right now?
Well, I see a lot of birds, which is fantastic. But on the not so fantastic side, we've got a lot of large puddles that have formed due to this unusually long rain spell, and they are corralled by piles of snow, and so they're not draining, and a few beds are just sitting there drowning, unfortunately.
I bet a lot of gardeners in Southeast Alaska are probably feeling the same way right now.
I imagine so. It's not common for such deep snow to have sat around for so long. And over the last couple of years, it's been hard to gauge what's going to happen from one week to the next.
Well, you are just a little more than a year into a new job of taking over the Jensen Olsen Arboretum. And it hasn't really been a very typical time. So it must be challenging to figure out what to do.
It has been challenging. It's been quite a unique year for me. I would say that 75% of the months that I have been here, almost 10 months out of the 12 or 13, there have been record-setting weather events. And because I'm new to the area, having relocated from Anchorage, I'll keep moving along as if this is the way it is. And then I hear, oh no, this isn't normal. So I'm having a hard time gauging how I should be planning my next year.
Well, I guess that's just it, is maybe there's a new normal and we've yet to figure that out. Now, I understand that you have been invited to speak at the Northwest Flower and Garden Conference down in the lower 48, and the interest there is in climate change and how that's changing the way that we garden. It's kind of interesting that's something that gardeners are tackling right now.
It is, and it is really important for horticulture all the way up to agriculture. It's going to impact how things grow, what pollinators show up and when. And we're interconnected here on the West Coast in this large Pacific temperate rainforest. So we have a lot in common with folks in the Pacific Northwest. And yes, we are kind of a laboratory. I like how you use that term, because as a public garden, we serve as an example of what people can learn that grows well or doesn't grow well, and we can trial things and reach out to other professional organizations to try to get different plants or species in, or work more with our native plants here. So yeah, we're gonna talk about, hey, it's happening and we need to understand this could be a great opportunity to try some new things.
Well, do you ever think about Carolyn Jensen, who started the gardens and that are now part of the Arboretum? I mean, are there things that you wish you could talk with her about? Because she was a great experimenter, I understand.
Yes, yes. Caroline thankfully left a wealth of information here, lots of wonderful photographs. She wrote quite prolifically and helped the Juneau Garden Club put together their book, Gardening in Southeast Alaska. So she was very knowledgeable and loved trying things out. I do wish I could talk to her. And I wonder, though, also what she would think about what's happened to the weather. Because our previous manager, Merrill, his observations were it was kind of predictable for him the first half of his tenure. And it's just really been in the last 5 to 10 years that the weather has become more erratic.
Well, I guess all the people who are fans of the Arboretum are probably thinking, how are those primroses doing? I guess because apparently the ones that grow there at the Arboretum, some of them are rare. You don't see them elsewhere.
That is true. We have quite an extensive collection, over 150 species, and some really wonderful signs of hope showed up last summer. If folks here in Juneau will remember, in 2019, there was an extreme long spell without rain. And in fact, the well was infiltrated with salt water here because it was used so much. And then followed by 2020 with the incredible record rainy summer. And so there were some species that didn't return those years. But last year, a couple of them made an appearance. Two in particular were Primula capitata and Primula waltonii. Capitata is a beautiful regal light purple, and waltonii is a nice ruby or wine red, but they were healthy and blooming. So you just never know who's hibernating and waiting it out. And until the summer comes, we won't know who decided to leave.
Boy, I tell you, it's always nowadays a guessing game. You can't really plan ahead for anything. But in fact, that's the name of your workshop, one of them that you're offering, Plan Ahead. It's kind
right.
of a conundrum.
Look to your neighbors. It is tough to think about planning ahead because you don't know what's going to happen. But if you see what's happening in your weather, and you look at other regions nearby and what they are doing, what plants they are using, it could lead to some ideas for other gardeners to try out in their yards.
Well, you know, you are always busy, even in the wintertime, getting ready for the next season. So what's on your to-do list right now, and what should other gardeners be thinking of?
Well, planning your vegetable garden, knowing what you want to grow, get those seeds now if you can. And when I return from the flower conference down in Seattle, that'll be mid-February, I'll start winter sowing. Winter sowing is a great way to get your plants adapted to the weather before moving them out. It is always good to start them inside here, as we know. But if we do winter sowing, we start them outside and they're ready to take off right when spring hits. So I've got my seeds collected, I'm laying out the veggie garden, and making a lot of preparations for this year. We'll be celebrating the 15th anniversary of the Arboretum. So we're talking about a lot of events with the friends of the Jensen Olsen Arboretum, our support group. And we look forward to sharing a lot of fun stuff soon.
Boy, 15 years. I mean, now it's an institution, kind of the oasis that people like to visit, a help center for gardeners. How will you mark this occasion?
Well, we will be having lots of on-site events where we'll be partnering with groups that have helped us get this far. The Friends of the Arboretum will be here many times throughout the summer. We'll be having Mother's Day here. A Primula Day will return. Alaska Public Gardens Day. Seal Trust will join us. Southeast Alaska Land Trust was instrumental in helping Caroline set up her conservation easement, which allowed it to be donated to the city. And so they'll talk about their work involved there and how what other work they do around the region. And we'll have all the garden groups, please. We'll be able to congregate at least outside. We'd like to share the space, get back to sharing it with all of our wonderful garden groups that contribute a lot here, the Juno Garden Club, the Master Gardeners. And usually we have a really big picnic with everyone, which has been waylaid for the past couple of years.
Oh, I bet people will be looking forward to that. So as you prepare for this anniversary, are there some things that you want people to think about, to do, find photographs or participate in some way?
That would be wonderful. Thank you for asking. If there are folks listening who knew Caroline, we're always looking to collect stories about how she welcomed people to her home. She used to have plant sales and plant giveaways. So it's always nice to hear what plants people may still have in their yards that they received from Caroline. And we hope to have a little display and some of the Friends of the Arboretum as docents in the City Museum and sharing the story with visitors who may be coming from out of state. So it's always helpful to be able to talk to folks about, oh yeah, well, Caroline was growing this 40, 50 years ago.
Well, you've moved here from Anchorage, and so what have you learned in the last year about growing things in this climate? Is there that much of a big difference between the two places?
The big difference, obviously, is the precipitation amounts. But we grow a lot of the same plants and a few more varieties here because it's a little more temperate. We don't have as many long, hard freezing spells. But the plants here definitely need to be able to withstand the moisture.
So any surprises for you in the last year, things you discovered as you worked out at the Arboretum?
Yes, I was really surprised to see a toad on the property, boreal toad. There's one that lives here, a resident, so that was pretty fun. You don't get to see those interior very often, or not at all. And there's a wonderful shrub here. It's a native shrub called Spirea deglacii, and I hope it puts on as great a show as it did last year. Beautiful pink flowers. It's easy to grow, and there's one of our lessons we can show people. This plant is from here and it's beautiful and it has taken well to cultivation. So I hope I'll get to share that more with folks this year.
So even though technically the winter is the down season, are you still available for consultation or, for example, if people want to make reservations for weddings and things like that come summer?
Yes, good question. A lot of folks think that arboretums and botanic gardens close in the winter. No, we're always planning. I am a year-round manager, and so I am available for folks to call or to email. And the grounds are actually open Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So if anyone wants to come see what it looks like, I would just advise you to bring your cleats and or your waders. But yes, I am happy to talk to people if they have questions or want to know what's going on at the Arboretum.
So what have you enjoyed the most about your new job, besides being in just a beautiful place?
Yes, that is a tough thing to say. It is a beautiful place, seeing the wildlife, but the support of the city, of the Parks and Recreation Department has just been amazing, and the community folks have been very friendly and very open in sharing their experiences, and that's been very helpful to me.
I had to laugh because last year one of the big events was a new outhouse.
Yeah, how's right.
How's that working? Got to get down to the nitty-gritty here.
Right. The outhouse is beautiful. It works fantastic. And I tell you, it is so much nicer than a porta potty. We had the same issue at the Alaska Botanical Garden when I worked up there in Anchorage. Once you get a nice structure built, it just is so much more welcoming. And I tell you, it's the first place a lot of people visit. But the wonderful thing is this year we had granted an artist to paint the inside. And so there's a beautiful mural of native plants and birds on the inside.
So it's not just an outhouse. It's kind of like the garden, something to go and see.
Yes, yes.
Okay, well, it's always a delight to talk with you, Ginger, especially now to talk about flowers on such a yucky kind of day. It does kind of recharge you a bit. So thanks, Ginger, for being here with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Support for Juno Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klinkit & Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.
Tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, Pour the Love Fundraiser. We'll talk about that event, which brings local breweries together to support some good causes. And we'll talk with Tom Matisse, the city and borough of Juneau's emergency manager, who has a lot to keep his eye on these days. We'll talk about avalanche danger and look back at how January's wet and warm weather kept his department busy. Thanks for joining us. Until next time, from all of us at KTOO, Gunashchish, have a good evening. KTOO, Juneau.